Good morning. My name is Lyle Cross, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, every time we do this, and I'm listening to that, I think, God, I wish there was something like 212 traditions. I could just sit there and let those go. What a wonderful way to spend a weekend. I couldn't have had a nicer weekend. I thank all of you for that. I thank the committee for their tremendously hard work in putting this thing together. A special thanks to Dan and Sheila for picking me up and taking good care of me. And it's just been a great convention. I've never been to one quite this large, and I find it can be a little intimidating. Also, you dress up for more of the events than I thought you did. I brought jeans and T-shirt for most of it. I figured San Diego's sandals and shorts, and I find you dressing up for all of these things. One of the really neat things, though, I think, about some of this is that, you know, like we have a dinner on Friday, and I got to sit next to our Friday night speaker, our Irish representative, Jim, and I talked, and it was a delightful conversation. And once I found out he was a retired judge, I thought, well, we have a lot in common in that I was on the other side of the bench. And when he closed his talk with that beautiful Irish farewell, I thought, I hadn't heard that for a long time. You know, may the road rise to meet you, and may the wind be ever at your back. And I was thinking about that later, and I thought, you know, I heard the last time I heard it, it went like, may the road always rise to meet you, and may the wind at your back never be your own. And I thought that must have been the Irish pub version when I was drinking. And suddenly it had a different look to it. Then I got to visit with Annie, and had heard that she was a flight attendant, and I told her, I said, God, between your story last night and my story this morning, these folks are going to be rushing en masse to the Greyhound bus depot. and I really enjoyed my time with Annie and with Roger and with all of you. I'm supposed to keep this thing simple. I'm going to tell you right up front, I have to race the clock. A lot of things happen. There are a lot of miracles that I have to skip right past. A lot of things that are deserving of some time, and I just simply don't have time to go into these things. You know, what happened, or what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. So let me start really with what happened. And I'll start with my sobriety date, which is pretty easy for me to remember. It's March 7th of 1990. And the reason it's really easy for me to remember is that I had some national celebration over that with Peter Jennings and Tom Brokaw and Dan Rather and all these folks who brought it to everybody's attention. And on March the 8th of 1990, the day following, March 7th, 8th, and 9th are very intensive days for me. They're like 3 days of the Kennedy assassination where I can look at my watch at any given moment and I know exactly what was taking place at that moment on any of those 3 days. But on March the 8th of 1990 at 7 a.m., an event happened at that time that had not happened before, and it had fallout and consequences that really have occurred since then, and that is that an entire airline crew was arrested as they walked off the airplane after landing at 7 a.m. on the morning of March the 8th at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. Then I realized we've had a series of pilot alcohol issues, but so far none of them have gone quite the way mine did. At any rate, I was the captain of that crew, and I can. It was my very distinct honor and privilege, and I was the first one off the airplane. And when I walked off and I saw this crowd of people that were gathering, which was comprised of FAA people, airline or airport police, and company officials, I knew the deal was done. I worked for Northwest Airlines. I could leave that airline anonymous, but for reasons that I hope you will understand, I do not do that. I could just say I worked for a major carrier, but Northwest at that time was the only major carrier that did not have a program for alcoholic pilots. I can assure you they have a good one today. they basically went from worst to first. And They were motivated as by a number of the other airlines and some of the professional organizations out there. So they put one in place, and they have a great program today. But I can tell you, when I walked off that airplane, that I knew that most likely my life had ended as I knew it at that point in time. I was an airline captain. I was at the top of my game. I walked off those four stripes. I walked into that crowd of people. And I spent some 12 hours that day going through an incredible, almost surreal experience that I often felt really and truly was happening as out of body. I mean, I believe that there were times when I felt like I was watching this occur to someone else. One of the head docs that works with pilots in aviation and has for 35 years talks about denial. He made a comment one time when I was at a workshop, and he said, "Thank God we've got it." And I sat up and I listened. I thought, well, I thought we had to get rid of it. And he said, "Denial is the mental mechanism that we have that allows us to deal with things that our mind simply cannot, the trauma that we cannot accept at that moment." And I believed I went through an entire day, a 12-hour period of that, in and out of that. And the shame was beyond description. And I was going through the big book not long ago with the sponsee, and I saw the phrase that summed it up, you know, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And that says it all. That really says it all. We gave blood twice that day at one of the facilities. Some reporter saw three airline pilots escorted by sheriff's deputies in uniform, and he rightly assumed there was a story there, and that was how it broke to the media. At the end of the 12 hours, we were kept separated. I just sat there just in abject despair, absolutely sick. Because I had not lived my life in such a way as to have it end on that day in that way. And the shame was just beyond me. It was absolutely overpowering. We subsequently gave sworn depositions to company attorneys. We had talked with airline of association attorneys, and it was very chaotic. At the end of the 12 hours, it was dark again. We were driven from the company headquarters back across the river towards the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. An assistant chief pilot drove us back, and I remember vividly looking outside at the blackness of the night and thinking, that represents my life. All of the light in my life has been extinguished as of today. I was not able to get home that night. I went to a commuter apartment that I had, and I tried to call home. I had forgotten that I was supposed to be home that night, and did not realize that my wife had waited at the Atlanta airport some 4 hours out there for me, and then finally gave up and went home. I got the answering machine, and all I could do was just get a very brief message out, a whispered message to the effect of, "There's been a disaster, and I think I've lost my job, and I will be in tomorrow on the very first flight." The next morning, I made my way through the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport as quickly as possible. It was not uncommon to have people turn and look at pilots in uniform, but that morning, every time someone looked at me, the shame just overpowered me. And I just knew they knew. I knew they knew what I had just done. And I got to the airport, and I got on the airplane, and there was space available in the first class section. And a man and a woman got on, and I don't remember who said what, but there was a response from either the flight attendant or the captain who were standing at the forward entry door, and they said, "Yeah, I know, we just heard about it." And I thought, oh God, they already know. And I had seen these sorts of things take place at my airline before, and they would sweep the airline, just cut through it like wildfire, and invariably the pilot was fired, and we got real careful for about 6 months because we knew that anything involving alcohol at my airline was instantly fatal. It was irrevocable. And it was without appeal. That was the way it was. And I got to the Atlanta airport, quickly made my way out of the Northwest area. I didn't want anyone to see me, stop me, talk with me, or anything. And I've never told the story, but what I didn't say, you know, I felt like I had to climb over the curb to get into the car, and I could not look at my wife. And all I could do was just get the words out, "Honey, I'm so sorry." And she pulled away from the curb, and I remember she said to me, "Well, who better than I could possibly understand how you feel right now?" And we drove home in silence, as I recall. And when we got home, I went inside. She left and went to work, and I went inside. The house was eerily quiet, and I got on the phone and I called a doctor, and I said, "I have to declare an emergency." And he cleared his calendar, and inside of about an hour, I went to his office. And I walked in, and frankly, I was so devastated I should not have been driving. I look back on it now, and I think, how did I even get in the car? How did I drive? I was so shredded. I was absolutely destroyed by this. And I got to his office, and I walked in, and I told him what had happened. And I remember the shock on his face. And he said, "God, Lyle," he said, "this is horrible." He said, "This is absolutely horrible." And then he kind of turned away, and he said, "But maybe this is what had to happen." And I guess maybe what I'll do is stop here and go back and pick up a little bit. And if I don't lose my place, I'll come back and restart the story from this place. But let me go back and give you some quick background. And that is that even though I'm introduced from Georgia, I grew up in the Kansas and Oklahoma area. I was born there in September of 1938. And to save the newcomers the math turmoil, I'll tell you, I'll be 64 at the end of the month. And some of the old timers, they're not any better. So, in Wichita, Kansas. And like so many of the people that come up here to this podium, I came from an alcoholic family. Both of my parents were alcoholics, and they died from this disease. I don't remember either of them ever getting to AA, although they may have, but they didn't stay. And home life was chaotic. And they divorced the first time when I was 14, and before I graduated from high school, they had been married and divorced two more times. And I would move from family to family. I usually had a clash or conflict with someone in that family, either a step-parent or a step-sibling, and so I would migrate back and forth. Usually by the time I'd done it once or twice, there was a whole new set of characters and players over there, so I was recycling. You know, interestingly, I do not remember any of their names. I truly don't. I don't remember their names. I have no idea if any of these people, either the stepmothers or stepfathers or the step-siblings, however and wherever and how many there were, I have no idea if they're alive today. Have no idea. I was a pretty good student in high school in spite of all of this. When I applied myself, the problem was no one was watching me, and I didn't apply myself very diligently. I remember my senior academic schedule was three study halls and a typing class. Not a huge challenge. And so I graduated from high school at the age of 17. A few months later, I turned 18. And we were poor. We lived on the outskirts of Wichita in a World War II housing project. In that housing project was a Native American community, and I was an active member of that. One grandmother is Irish, one grandmother is Comanche. Many find that a very interesting drinking combination with a very predictable outcome. And I'm certainly a representative of it, but nonetheless, I was very active in the Native American community. And I had seen the alcoholism in my family, said, "I will never be like that, I'll never drink like that, I'll never behave like that." And I remember powwowing all over Oklahoma. After the first divorce, I spent most of my time with a Kiowa family, and they were very traditional. They didn't drink. It was a very warm family. I just went home a few weeks ago and buried my adopted Kiowa mom, and they were a huge resource to me. They were like a rudder that gave the ship some stability and steering, able to steer a course for me. And they were very, very important to me, and they played a very important role in my growing up. But I was always with this family, and we powwowed all over Oklahoma. And I remember that some of the many small towns that we were in, and I would see these drunk Indians along the street, and they disgusted me and repelled, and I thought I was ashamed, and I said, "I'll never be like that either." So my goal was always to watch my drinking, monitor my drinking, and make sure that always in the back of my mind, comparing myself to these folks that I had seen and never be like them. And the obvious conclusion that I came to is if I could drink and behave differently, then I was not one of them, i.e. I was never going to be an alcoholic. And that was what I believed. I knew, you know, I look back and I think, you know, I knew an awful lot about alcoholic behavior, but I knew absolutely nothing about this disease. If, in fact, I even believed it was a disease. I really hadn't considered it much because it was not going to be a factor in my life, I didn't think. So when I graduated from high school, not too many people from my area went to college. And the big deal was to marry your 18-year-old high school sweetheart and go to work for either Boeing, Beach, or Cessna, all of whom are big employers there in Wichita, or go to the service. And this was in 1956, and I was thinking about joining the service, and there seems to be an inordinate number of people from Kansas that love to join the Navy to go see some water, and I wasn't particularly enamored with that, and some went to the Army. There was an Air Force base there. Some went to the Air Force. I had a friend come back about that time from the Marine Corps, and boy, did he look good. I mean, that uniform just sparkled, and so he and I spent an afternoon and an evening in the bar as he regaled me with these masochistic horror stories of Marine boot camp and this process that he had gone through. And I probably should have checked with a psychiatrist. He could have saved me a lot of trouble later on in my life and said, you know, your thinking is really screwed up, because I just couldn't wait to go down and do that. And I had this fascination for this thing. Actually, I'm not sure I could do that. It was a real challenge. So I ran down to the Marine recruiter and I signed up. And on December the 5th of 1956, off I went to Marine boot camp. Right out here. As a matter of fact, every time I land at this airport and I look out there, I go, oh, there's my old home. 13 weeks of MCRD San Diego, and I can remember being in there looking up on the hills, seeing the houses, and thinking, oh, my God, there's normal people up there. They're eating and drinking and laughing and having a good time, and I'm down here in this pit of disaster and torture, wondering if I would ever get out. And I'll tell you, I had a great boot camp experience. At the end of 13 weeks, I had done extremely well. You know, I mean, I felt like I belonged there. It was tough. It was disciplined. It was structured. A tremendous amount of camaraderie among the recruits as we came together, and we lost probably half of the guys we started with. But I really loved that process, and I found I was very good at what we were supposed to do. I found I could do things I never thought I could do in that place. The drill instructors had a great way of motivating me to that, but nonetheless, they were going to award three sets of PFC stripes at the conclusion of boot camp, and to my very complete shock, surprise, and dismay, I got one of those sets of PFC stripes. And then we went up here to Camp Pendleton for combat training, and I was enjoying all the perks of my newfound rank. I thought, man, I'm moving up fast. General probably is not very far out on the horizon. And some 4.5 years later, I came in, and the commanding officer called me over, and he said, I had some extraordinarily high test scores, entry scores, and I have no earthly idea why or how that occurred. I truly don't, but they were very, very high. And he called me and said, you know, there's a new program out, and if you're interested, you're the only guy in the unit that's qualified to attempt to go there. And it was a flight training program, and I had always wanted to fly. But I came from the other side of the tracks, and I knew that those people who flew had to have college educations, and I was never going to have a college education. And I examined this opportunity, thought about it, and I went and I took a full day of testing for it. I passed all the tests. And they assured me that if you can pass the test, you can complete this 18-month program, but I wasn't so sure. I still had all this fear because I knew that because I was enlisted, I was able to test out for it, and that my peers coming in were going to have these college educations. And I wasn't sure I could complete. And I do not like to fail. I don't handle failure well. I decided to make the attempt, and I went home to Wichita, and there was a powwow going on there, and I went, and they had what they call a special for me. I was going away, and it was a very important event for me. It really imprinted me and impacted me, and as I drove to Pensacola, all I could think of is I cannot fail. I cannot fail. I cannot go back to this Indian community and tell them that I'm back because I failed, because I knew on the way down there, I had a lot of time to think that I had an opportunity they weren't going to have, that if I was successful, I was going to get a set of gold wings. I was going to be a pilot. I was going to be an officer. I was going to get a commission. I had always admired and respected the Marine Corps officers I had seen, and that was almost such a far reach to be able to think of that. It was on the far edge of any dream I could have had. So I went through the 18 months of flight training, and there were some significant events in there, but I absolutely excelled in there. But the interesting thing was, I never thought I was doing well. I never thought I was doing very well. I was always fearful of washing out. I was watching guys pack up almost daily, certainly weekly, and with those looks of shame and dejection as they got all their gear and cleaned it out and left. And I just knew that no matter, someplace along the way, regardless of how well I was doing, that was going to happen to me. So I never transferred any level of confidence. I always ended up right at the top of my class. But I always thought it was luck. It was just luck. Something administratively got mixed up, and I shouldn't be there. And the next phase of training, they would certainly find out, and off I would go. In the last phase of training, I left the Florida area for 6 months of advanced jet training, and I went to Beeville, Texas. And I reunited with a whole bunch of my friends that we had gotten separated along the way. It was Friday afternoon. It was before Vietnam. We weren't flying on the weekends. And we all went to the officers club, and boy, did we get splashed. And I was glad to see these guys. They were glad to see me. We decided to go into the little town of Beeville. A lot of good-looking South Texas girls in there, I'll tell you what. And they said, well, and they love cadets. And so I was never very aggressive with the gals, but I went with them. And I hung back. They approached a carload of local girls. It was an old-fashioned drive-in. And I still didn't think that I had quite enough to drink yet to make this attempt, this foray up there. And finally, I decided I would go through. I noticed the driver wasn't talking to anyone, and I walked up, and she turned and looked at me, and I was just breathless. And she looked, and the only thing I could think of to say was, "You've got the most beautiful brown eyes I've ever seen." And then everything departed. I had no more thoughts. My brain slammed shut, and I really want to say something hip, slick, and cool, and nothing's happening. And I feel we've had that amount of time now. And I feel like a real ass, and I'm looking at her expression, and it seems that she thinks that also. And I just turned around and left, and I thought, I need some more to drink. The next day I was in town with a cadet buddy of mine. We were heading back to the base, and I saw her and a girlfriend head into this restaurant. Same place, they also had an indoor restaurant, and I said, there's that girl. And so we wheeled in there. I feigned a lot of surprise. Oh, and I was sober and nice, and bought him a cup of coffee, and we sat and talked, and she gave me her name. I called her, and we began to date, and on February the 25th of 1963, I got my wings and my commission on that very day, the same day, and she pinned both of those on me, and it was her 20th birthday. And I asked her to go home to Kansas with me, meet my parents, which was risky, but at best. And while we were there, we decided to get married. So we ran down to Newkirk, Oklahoma, and got married. And that was March the 9th. So when I talk about March 7th, 8th, and 9th, it has a connection there. And I'm pleased to tell you that next March the 9th, the girl with those beautiful brown eyes and I will celebrate 40 years together. In an attempt to be humorous one time, when I had to speak, I said, because I'd heard so many stories, and I know what this disease does to us and relationships, you know, and I've heard people say, well, and then after my third husband and after my fifth wife, then this happened. And so I got up there, and I thought I would really wow them, and I said, I'm one of those rare alcoholics who does not speak of marriage in multiples. And it got about the same reaction it just now got. So I decided I better drop that. But she was in the audience, and we were headed home, and she said, you know when you said that? And I said, yeah. And she said, I just want you to know that that is not your fault. I have never considered her a master of the one-liner, but she followed that up with the statement. She says, as a matter of fact, the only reason I stayed married to you is because I couldn't stand to admit I'd made a mistake. Yeah. We had a great life together. We came out here to El Toro, and I began. I was assigned to one of the finest Marine jet squadrons I think has ever taken the field. What a group of people, and I got to be part of that squadron. We quickly had a son, 8 days less than a year apart. Here came the second son, and I used to tell people, I'm not a Catholic, and I'm not even a very careful Protestant. And we were having a great career. Life was going well. And I headed for Vietnam in 65 when my two boys were 6 months old and 18 months old. I went over there. We were one of the first jet squadrons in country. I drank very hard. But then all my friends drank hard. That was part of the persona. We were supposed to do that, and I didn't need any extra encouragement to be at a happy hour if I wasn't flying. And I would literally be the last one out that O Club door Friday night. And yet, back in those days, I'd be up at 7 o'clock in the morning washing the car, cutting the grass. I was on my way. I was having a full day, and it didn't seem to affect me a lot. And while I was in Vietnam, I received a regular commission, which were very competitive back in those days. And I didn't think a guy with a high school education would even be in the running, but I got a regular commission over there. I was a lifer. I intended to stay. My wife is a great Marine Corps wife. Everybody liked her. She's a great gal. And she thought that that was really where my calling was, and that's where I wanted to stay. I love the people. I love the flying. I love the career. But I began to look at this and say, you know, I'm going to have a family separation of about 4 to 6 years. And I got to tell you, when I got married, you know, my dedication and my focus was on my family. I said, never will my family be like the one I grew up in. And I told Barbara, I said, I don't care what our finances are. I want you at home with those kids. And so that's what she was. She was a stay-at-home mom. And as I examined this thing, I thought, you know what, I'm going to have to resign. I can't be gone that much and expect to have a family that survives all this. So very painfully, in a very anguished manner, I sat down and wrote my letter of resignation. And I hated to do it. I really hated to do it. And I got out, and I didn't want to go with the airlines. I thought it would be pretty dull and boring after the type of living I had been used to. But I didn't have a college degree, and there weren't a whole lot of them knocking at my door. There were several. So I decided to go to Northwest Airlines, and I did that. I got out of the Marine Corps July the 15th of 68, had some decorations, and I had a terrific reputation in there, and I had a lot of accomplishments and a lot of really neat things that I was very, very proud of. And 2 weeks later, August the 5th of 68, I was in class at Northwest Airlines. I was there almost 22 years before the wheels came off. Now, when we came to Northwest, we went up to Minnesota, and Barbara and I had talked about adopting a child even before we got married, and so I said, let's do that if we're going to do it. So we had the two boys, and we fought a very difficult, hard, long battle and adopted a little Chippewa girl up there. And it was difficult because it was right at the edge of that time where if you already had two of your own kids, it was difficult to adopt. But we really fought like hell, and we're very tenacious about it. And this little girl came to live with us when I was out of work. I was out of work 6 times in the first 10 years at Northwest Airlines. Other airlines used to call us Cobra Airlines because you never knew when they were going to strike. And so I had about 19 months on the street, 6 strikes. My career goal had been to eventually, hopefully, get a W-2 that had all the months of the year in it. And wasn't sure that was ever going to happen. And I was out of work, and I was working 2 and 3 jobs at a time to keep food on the table. One of the things I want to, at any rate, we got this little girl, and she came to our house when she was 17 days old, beautiful little girl. One of the things I think is important, I heard an Indian guy say this at Red Road Convention in Albuquerque, and he got very tearful and emotional about it, and he was talking about his alcoholic mom. And he said something that was very important to me. He said, you know, I have to remember that she wasn't drunk all the time, that she taught me some very good things. And I went up to him later and hugged him, and I said, thanks for that, Al. I said, I need to remember that. And my parents weren't drunk all the time, and they taught me some very good things, and they instilled in me some very good qualities and some ethics and some things that I, to this day, I can hear their voices talking to me as they exhort me to do this or that. I have never had a problem with a work ethic. It doesn't bother me if I have to get down dirty, sweaty, and whatever. Whatever I have to do to accomplish the goal or meet the needs, I do that. And I don't have an ego that gets in the way of that. And I was working these two and three jobs to keep the family afloat. And they, because we had fought so hard for this little girl, I said, no, it's only one's more smallmouth. It will make no difference. So we brought her home. She was every father's dream. She was a beautiful little girl, and I thought it was a neat deal that Barbara had her little daughter, but what I didn't know was what daughters do to their dads. And I mean, this little girl could not walk past me without me making her come over. I'd say, Don, come over here and give me a hug. And she would. We were very open about the adoption. We didn't talk about it every day, but she was very comfortable with all of this. But I'd say, come over here and give me a hug, and she'd come give me a hug, and I would hug her, and I would look at her, and I'd say, thanks for being my girl. And she would say, thanks for being my dad. And she was really the center of my universe. And 2 years before this incident that I just described and the arrest, I had passed up becoming a captain because she was my last child at home. I didn't want to be gone as a junior captain. And she was in her senior year of school. I said, it's time for me to be a captain. So I put a card in so I could go to Chicago and take a special written test so that I could then move up to become a captain at Northwest Airlines. Unbeknownst to either Barbara or myself, she had made plans when she knew that this was getting ready to occur. And she and or some of her friends came over and cleaned her room out that afternoon when Barbara took me to the airport and she ran away. And I didn't know about it until the next day. I called home and was ready to come home. And Barbara just answered the phone, and I knew something was wrong. And I forced her to tell me what it was. And Barbara hadn't discovered it until late that night when she went into Dawn's room. And there was a note and a lot of stuff gone. And so I blurted out all these instructions about where to go, who to call, where to look, and who to contact. But a strange thing happened. It took me 2.5 hours to get home on the airplane from Chicago. And by the time I landed, all of that had changed. I hated her. God, I hated her with a passion and a rage that defies description. And I told Barbara, I said, forget all of that. I said, she will never come home again, not as long as I'm alive. Not only that, I want no one in this family to ever mention or breathe her name to me, not as long as I'm alive. Ever. Within 2 days, I had cleared all of the remaining furniture out of her room. That had all gone to Goodwill. Everything that she had ever touched in that house was gone. I'd given it away. I had found some things that she had made for me that I deeply cherished and treasured, little girl things that she had come through school. I smashed and broke those and destroyed them. I went to the bank where the adoption papers were, and I ripped those up. And then I went to an attorney and gave him $500 and disowned her. And then I tried to annul the adoption and could not do that. In the process of doing this, I was looking around and I decided that Barbara was having some problems handling this. And I'm a very benevolent dictator in my home. So I picked the phone book up and called a family therapist. And by luck of the draw, I got a good one. So we went in to see him. He was the doctor that I referred to a moment ago. He was the only doctor I knew to call. And we had seen him almost weekly for 2 years about this family issue. And on the introductory meeting when we went in there, he said, as we were leaving, we told him why, what had happened and why we thought we would be coming there. And on the way out, he said, by the way, he said, as long as you're coming to see me, he said, I don't want either one of you drinking. And there had been no mention of drinking, none. And I said, fine. And we walked outside, and we got in the car, and I asked Barbara, I said, what the hell do you think he meant by that? And because it seemed really bizarre and abstract to me. And she said, I don't know. And I, because I... To be a pilot, you've got to have this very quick, analytical, cut-through-everything mind, and I exercised those powers at that moment, and I said, he obviously means on the day we're coming. And everything fell into place at that moment, and so I said, not a problem. So we had seen this doctor for a couple of years. We never talked about my drinking. And I got to tell you, it's not because I deliberately hid it. I truly didn't think it was a problem. It never came up because it was not relevant. Barbara never brought it up. I never did. And I didn't, while I was trying to participate in this process, I did not like talking about my daughter. And one time something came up about her, and I, every time I tell this, I can just see it as though it were happening. And he said something to me, and I looked at him, and I said, I'm going to tell you something, doctor. I said, I'd rather hate than hurt. And I do not remember ever having had that conscious thought. I don't remember ever having formulated that idea before. But the words flew out of my mouth, and they certainly expressed everything I was about. And he looked at me, and he said, Lyle, he said, you survived a childhood doing that. But he said, if you continue this, he said, it will destroy you. And I didn't respond, but I looked at him, and going through my mind was, well, you may be a Ph.D. doctor therapist, but I'm an airline pilot, and and I'll do it my way. Thank you. He was absolutely right. He was right about everything he told me. And later, I mean some years later, and I'll say it while I'm thinking about it, this doctor had a volume of reports on us and me, and I read many years later, a summary of his report after some 2 years of therapy. And he said, based on the background and history of this man, it was unlikely to believe that he would ever be a productive member of society. And I remember thinking, my God, that's pretty dismal. And then I thought, well, what the hell? I'm the one that gave him the information. And so I had drank very hard and heavy over this incident for the past 2 years preceding my arrest. And, you know, it's not her fault I'm an alcoholic. I had become an alcoholic a long time earlier than that. I just didn't see it, didn't know about it, didn't recognize it, and didn't believe it. And I had 1,000 reasons why I couldn't be an alcoholic. You know, I've heard hundreds of stories like most of you have. You know, I didn't drink every night. I would vary my drinking patterns. Rarely drank in the mornings. Didn't get drunk every weekend. I'd heard that alcoholics could stay drunk for anywhere from 3 days to 3 weeks. I couldn't do that. Usually the last thing I wanted after a good drunk was another drink, although by the time 5 o'clock would come that day, I'm thinking, I'm feel pretty good, you know. But I had a lot of reasons I didn't beat or abuse my family, not physically. I certainly did verbally. I was at the top of my game, and there was no way that I could be an alcoholic. No way. So we had not ever discussed any of these things, and but I had drank very hard and heavy, mostly an isolated, solitary drinker. And the fact that I was out with these two guys this particular afternoon and evening in Fargo, North Dakota, was really was very unusual. But thank God I was, because it led to a beginning of a new life, although I didn't know it at that time or that moment. Nonetheless, I went in and talked with this doctor. And he left and called another doctor, and he came back and he said, "You've got an appointment tonight. This is a Friday, at 6 o'clock tonight, to go see this doctor. I was on staff with him at a treatment center earlier in my career, and this doctor was himself a recovering alcoholic and cocaine addict, and he was a very, very prominent Atlanta doctor. And the idea of me going to see a very successful, prominent doctor at 6 o'clock on a Friday evening struck me as being indicative of how serious they thought this was. So I drove over and I saw this doctor, and I don't remember anything he said to me. My wife went with me. Again, I should not have been driving. I don't know how I got there, how I got back. I don't remember anything he said to me. I don't even know how long I was in the room. I don't know if it was 30 minutes or an hour. But I do remember him looking at me, and there was no guile on my part. I answered the questions as best I could. And he looked at me and said, "Well, you're an alcoholic." And he said, "You need to go into treatment tonight." And I don't remember any shock or reaction at that. And I've always hated that word. But yet there was no reaction when he told me that. And I said, I thought you would probably tell me that. And I'm not resistant to going into treatment. But what I would like to do, please, please, is just let me go home. Let Barbara just hang on to me. Just please let her hang on to me. Let my mind uncoil and let me absorb what's happened here. And I mentioned, I said, I just want to pull the drapes and let her hang on to me. And he said, you need to go into treatment tonight. And I stood there for just a moment, and I thought, you know, I'll never have the money to pay whatever it is he's going to charge me. Why would I come all the way over here if I'm now going to do what he said? And I guess it was my first lesson in willingness, and I said, okay. We drove back across Atlanta following these instructions, and it was dark. And as we made the final turn, the lights hit this sign that is no longer there. But it was like the shock of what we see when we put something in writing and we write down the fourth step or we do anything and the words are there. And I saw Anchor Hospital, a hospital for alcoholism and other chemical dependencies. And I thought, my God, how have I ended up here? And so we drove down the hill. Many pilots have, and I'm no different, a special little room. We call it an I Love Me room. And there on this room, there are trophies and plaques and certificates and combat photos and awards. I mean, it just, you can just go in there and read my life. And they're neat things that I was very proud of. And at that moment, when I saw that sign, it was like somebody just took this eraser and wiped it all out. And I, the sum total of my life at that moment had come to a complete, absolute zero. I had no self-worth. We drove down the hill, and I'm thinking, oh, God, a treatment center. And the only thing I can think of is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I go in there, it was not anything at all like that. Now, I didn't want anybody in there to know who I was, what I was, or anything. Within days, the media had the story. It was all over the television. Everybody knew. The morning after I had gone in, there was a Saturday. I went in on a Friday night. It was a Saturday morning, which was a weekend routine for the patients, and they enjoyed it. I did not. I didn't know anybody. I walked out this place. It was 5 minutes south of the Atlanta airport. I did not know that. Never heard of this place. And a U.S. Air 727 took off behind me. Instinctively, I whirled to look at it. And as I watched this airplane, which was very close, the reality hit me that you'll never fly again. You'll never see the inside of a cockpit again. And I began to get sick, and I felt it coming up. And so I swallowed a couple of times, and I turned my back, and I walked away. And I couldn't watch it. And I walked over, and I sat down. There were some chairs by a rec area. And I just wanted to be alone. I didn't want anyone talking to me. And I sat down, there was a foot and a half or so between these chairs, and there was a guy sitting to my left, and I sat there, and he said, and I don't know who he was talking to, I don't know if he's talking to the flowers, the birds, the sky, or what, but anyway, he says, made a remarkable statement. He said, you know, if I only had a month to live, this is where I'd want to be. Now, I'd only been there one night. And it sounded a little strange to me. And I didn't look at him because I didn't know if he was talking to me or not. And I said, oh, really? And he says, yeah, because every goddamn day here seems like a year. And later, I learned that that was his version of one day at a time. And I had an intense, very intense treatment process in there, and I there are many things I'd like to talk about, and I simply cannot, but I was suicidal in the first few days in there. I will tell you that I hit a level of pain that I didn't think the human threshold went to. I hurt more than anything. The shame was killing me. My entire life, I had striven to always do my best. Every time I put on that Marine Corps uniform, my airline uniform, every time I represented my family, my heritage, my profession, I had always tried to do it to the best of my ability. I tried to reflect honor and pride and dignity on everything that I did. And it's in the media now, and I'm a national disgrace. And it was killing me. And I went beyond the idea of flirting about suicide. The only time I'd ever considered suicide was in Vietnam when I wondered if I would allow myself to be captured if I were shot down. And I wrestled that back and forth and never resolved it. But I became suicidal in there and was going to do it because I wanted the pain to end. And someplace in that process, before I could actively conclude that, I had what we all refer to as a God-given moment of clarity. And I thought, you know, my family will never survive that. It'll be the only thing that's worse than what's already happened. So I gave that up. But I decided, and I don't know if it's a Native American thing or what, but I decided I could will myself to die. And I devoted countless foot-pounds of energy in that endeavor. I really just wanted to fall over and die. I wanted my heart to stop with no shame, no disgrace, and just die. And I don't know where in the 28 days that changed for me, where I began to think about living instead of dying. But someplace in there it did. And suddenly, here comes the legal consequences. My God Almighty. I didn't think I could deal with what I already had, and now here comes legal consequences that no one knew about. None of the attorneys had even remotely known about this. A week from the day that I walked in there, the television announced that I had been fired by Northwest Airlines, and I should have been. And they announced that the FAA had exercised what they rarely do, and that was a very public revocation of my licenses. And they were right to do that, too. I wasn't fit to hold them. So I had already lost everything. And now out comes the legal consequences. And I'm having a difficult time. I mean, they're having to come tell me this. We had no phone calls, no visitors. But they're having to come tell me what's going on in this arena. And there were six legal consequences that I went through, 2 to 3 days apart. And I'm telling you, every time they would come in the room and start to look around the faces of the patients, I just tensed because they would see me and motion me out like this, and I just didn't want to go outside. And it went from bad to worse to worse to worse to worse. And every time they told me this, it was just like they sucked the air out of the room and I couldn't breathe. And it would take me 2 or 3 days to just kind of catch up and sit and be still and accept what they had just told me. And 2 or 3 days later, I would repeat that process all over again. And I'm not kidding you, it was beyond anything I thought I could bear. Interestingly, in the second week of that treatment process, we went into a group. The gift that God gave me was that I was so destroyed that when I went there, I didn't argue, debate, question, quiz, analyze, intellectualize. I didn't do anything. When they told me something, I didn't often understand it, but I certainly accepted it. And so I was in this group, and I wasn't intending to talk, wasn't intending not to talk, but for whatever reason, I began to talk about my daughter. And I broke down and cried in front of this group. And I have never done that before. I didn't even cry at my parents' funerals because I thought I was not supposed to. That I was tough, I was hard, and as a man, I didn't cry. I just sucked it up and did it. And I cried in front of this group. And I felt so naked, so naked. But I look at that and I said that was one of the most important things that happened to me in treatment because it was like somebody completely sliced me open and lanced this boil that was festering and I let it come to the sunlight and begin to heal. And shortly thereafter, I was able to write to my daughter within days and say, I want to see you again. And I didn't know where she was, but Barbara did. She had a small granddaughter, our daughter. I didn't know anything about this except what Barbara had leaked. She had gotten married. I didn't know her last name. And the hospital thought this was such a breakthrough, they allowed her to come up. And I met with her and my new granddaughter in the day room of a treatment center for alcoholics. 6 months after she had run away, number two son, who had always had a problem with alcohol and drugs, had flunked out of college for the second time. I told him, take off, high alcohol. Just don't come back. Do the Nancy Reagan thing. Just say no. And when you can do that, come back and see me. But in there, I had gotten a glimpse of what the disease was about. I was getting an education, so I wrote to him. I said, let's put the family back together again. These two doctors asked if they could please come see this. Later, the family therapist said, I don't know what happened to you in there, but he said, I had written this off. 2 years of seeing you, and he said, this family was never coming back together again. He said, you were so staunch, so rigid, so unyielding. He said, there was no possibility of any kind of reconciliation. He said, what happened to you? I said, treatment happened to me. So I saw my daughter for the first time in 2 years, and I'd forgotten how little she was and what it felt like to put my arms around her and tell her how much I loved her instead of how much I hated her. And we healed that relationship, and we have a relationship today, and the family came back. And the number two son has got about 7 years of sobriety right now, and I think he's on a very slippery slope right now, but he knows where the help is if he needs it. So many good things have happened already. And I completed the treatment process. I came up to Minnesota. I was arraigned. It was a very public trial. Media everywhere. I had a jump on the other two guys because I had just very little bit of sobriety. But I had access to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would come to you at night in the meetings. And at first, you know, after this trial process, which was exhaustive, then I would come in there and first, and people would recognize me, and I would tense a little bit, and then I'd realize that I was in a safe place. And I could do this, and I could get recharged for the next day, and they couldn't do that. I was at a meeting one night, and a guy kept looking at me, and it was bothering me. He kept looking at me. And at the meeting, when it was over with, he walked over and he said, "My name's so-and-so." He said, "I just want you to know my mom was on that airplane." And I thought, oh, my God. And before I could react, a grin flashed across his face, and he said, "She said it was one of the best flights she ever had." I asked for her name. I wanted to put her on our witness list. And we went through this trial, which is an unbelievable experience. Many people commented about the way I handled it versus the other two guys, and I don't know what they saw, but I know one thing. I was absolutely shredded through the whole process. And we were very quickly found guilty. And some months later, we went back for the sentencing. And there was a long story that's involved, and then I'd love to share it with you, and I can't because of the time problem. And this judge had been very angry throughout this whole thing, and he had every right to be angry because it was a horrible betrayal of the public trust. And I saw his anger in there for 3 solid weeks. And he had leaked to the press that he was going to up the sentence. He was going to depart well above the sentencing guidelines, and the prosecutor had not even asked for it. And I rose to speak in front of him, and I had been so scared I couldn't come up with anything. I had no idea, even as I spoke to speak, what I was going to say. And I had just said, "God, please let me say something from the heart." And I've got a hostile judge and a hostile jury and hostile press behind me, and not many friends in that room. And I talked about my gratitude. I was grateful to be sober. I was grateful for my family having come back together again. I accepted responsibility, and I couldn't do anything about yesterday, much less what had happened months before. I accepted. And he looked at me from the bench, and he said he imposed a sentence of 16 months. I was expecting 18 under the guidelines. I thought he was going to go about 5. And I'd had 2 dreams to that effect that I finally shared with my wife after we'd gotten this bad news about the upward departure. And the courtroom was stunned that he sentenced me to less under the guidelines, and the press had even been told this. Then I sat down, my lawyer said, "Did he say 16 or 60? Have a great story about my attorney, but again, time doesn't permit. I had a relationship with this man that is unbelievable. No one knows an attorney like the one I had. He worked for me for something like 2 years or so, after the 3 years after the conviction, and never took a cent from me. I didn't have it to give him. His statement to me always was, "I believe in you, and I'm going to stay to the end, wherever that is." The judge put sanctions on me at the sentencing that made it impossible I would ever fly again. No way. And when we were sentenced, he said, and I hadn't expected this, but he said, "This is a complex legal case, a first of its kind ever case." And he said, "I'm going to allow you 3 to remain free pending the exhaustion of your appeals." The other two said, "Fine." I said, "Nope, I'm going to prison." I said, "I've been convicted and it's time for me to go, and I'm going." He says that to this day, no defendant has ever done that before. And he didn't know quite what to do. And, well, I had learned in here, we live life on life's terms. Whispering in the dark has no place in my recovery. And it was time to go. I remembered also something back in an English class that said, "A coward dies 1,000 deaths, a brave man only 1. I had been through so many countdowns to so many of these disastrous events, I was not going to do any more countdowns. So I went to prison in the one place I didn't want to go, right there in Atlanta. I served 14 months with good conduct time, 424 one days at a time, shorter when necessary. I don't talk much about the prison experience, although I had many experiences in there. I say prison has nothing to do with my recovery. Recovery has a lot to do with how I dealt with prison in there. I used to have inmates come up and say, "How come they can't get to you? How come this and how come that?" And I'd say, "It's too simple for you to understand." I make two statements about prison. I say it's a sick, obscene process. The goal of prison is to emotionally scar and castrate me to the point I will never recover and that I will come back someday. I say there are two groups of extraordinarily sick people in prison, and the sickest group goes home every night based on what I saw. I had a corrections officer come up to me. Obviously, who was clapping is not a correction. A guy came up and said, would you please change your story? I said, no, I will not change my story. I said, I always issue the caveat that if you're a corrections person and you're in this fellowship, you don't belong in the group I just described. And if that's not sufficient, then call your sponsor. The other thing I found particularly unsettling was that I made 12 cents an hour, 96 cents a day, and there was no 401k plan. I came out of prison as inmate 04478-041. I was never to fly again. I was the most notorious pariah in commercial aviation. Everyone knew my name. Everybody knew about this incident. I had been stripped of everything. Within the first 30 days of this experience, we were broke. We had lost everything. It was all gone. I had grown up poor. I had done well, and it was all gone. And I had a meditation book, though, that said, before any dream can come true, there must first be a dream. And I began to think about flying again. In a story that's far too long for me to go through here, I began to pursue the written exams again. The FAA had said I had held the highest license that they awarded, the ATP license, Airline Transport Pilot. No one I knew thought it was possible to go back and get that alone. And I thought, if I can do that, they will waive all the lower ones because I'm performing to the highest tolerance that they can provide. And the FAA said, if you want your licenses, you'll start with a private license all over again. And that made it impossible. That just made it impossible. But I have learned how to do things in this program one day at a time, one thing at a time. And I sat for a couple of days just trying to take deep breaths and collect myself, and I said, I will do this. So I started, and it took me 10 and a half months, and I passed all of the four written exams with an average of 94. I went over the high rung of the ladder, and I was not aiming for the low part. And then I began to look at the flying, and I said, not possible. I had gone back out of prison and was working in the treatment center that had saved my life. I was working full-time with Alcoholics and Addicts, and I was making $6.75 an hour, and we were broke. No way. About that time, I get a phone call and a letter from a Northwest pilot who had a flight school, and I was not aware of this. I get him on the same day, and he said, I want you to come live with me and go through my flight school free. I had to coordinate. I was under 3 years of supervised release, 13 conditions of probation attached to that. I had to coordinate with Georgia Corrections, go up to Minnesota, check in with Minnesota Corrections. I spent 44 days living with that wonderful man and his family. It was in the summer of 93 when the monsoon rains were flooding the country, and we had these massive floods. I had 14 days that it rained me out up there, and I couldn't fly, but I was always studying. I have learned to work hard. I know how to work hard. In the remaining 30 days, I flew 78 hours, and I got four licenses back, two of them in one day, and I don't think that has ever been done before. 3 months after I had gotten these licenses, 3 months after that, I received a phone call from the head of the pilot union at Northwest Airlines, and I had not challenged my firing. A grievance had automatically been fired, but I had not activated. I thought Northwest was justified in firing me based on what I did, so I never challenged it. And this man tells me, he said, this is the best phone call I've ever made because 3 hours ago, John Dasburg, president, CEO of Northwest Airlines, personally reinstated you to flight status at Northwest Airlines. The judge had lifted the sanctions on me, and I went past that part. But I was overwhelmed with emotion, and as I walked inside, Barbara knew who I was talking to, and I could not speak. And she stood up, and I hugged her, and all I could get out was, we're going back. And I said, I don't want to fly up there. Let's drive. I want to retrace the entire path that we took for the trial. I want to stop and stay at the same places. I'd had her read to me out of the big book in the 12 and 12 as we spent 2.5 days driving to Minnesota trying to brace and gear for this experience. I said, let's see what it feels like now. We went back up there, and on a very emotional afternoon with a large crowd of people, I signed a back-to-work agreement. I was never to be a captain again, but I didn't simply care. I couldn't believe that I had been restored within my flying community, within the company that I had so shamed and disgraced, and they were taking me back. and the act of courage on the part of that CEO and collectively on the part of the executive management team at Northwest was beyond anything I will ever understand, because if I relapsed or had a flying incident, the media would have massacred him, absolutely massacred him, and I'll never understand why they took that chance on me. So I went back, and the miracles in this program continue to come. They just don't stop. Even though each time one has occurred, I'd said, that's it. Nothing will ever eclipse this one. And I was speaking at United Airlines, approaching my final year at Northwest, and I was back in the hotels late at night. Barbara was with me, and the phone rang in the middle of the night, and I got it, and he said, the same pilot who's no longer head of the pilot union, he said, you're not going to believe this. John Dasburg has changed his mind. He wants you to be a 747 captain again. And so I went back, and I went through the checkout, and I completed my final year as a 747 captain. I worked on the Northwest Airlines Alcohol Committee with recovering pilots. This judge, who harbored such strong feelings about me and the other two guys, has had an incredible transformation over these 12 years. I've not seen this man since I stood in his courtroom. But based on many things that I haven't had time to talk about, he has become probably my strongest supporter. And he said to me in late 98, he knew I was an avid hunter and outdoorsman, and he said, and he knew also that I was a convicted felon, and I couldn't have guns. And so I started hunting with a compound bow. I used to tell my friends, you know, if we'd had compound bows 500 years ago in Alcoholics Anonymous, you whites would still be trying to get across the Hudson River. Which is probably true. Nonetheless, he said, if you want to make an attempt for a presidential pardon, he said, I will support it, and I have never, in my 16 years on the federal bench, ever supported a petition for pardon. That night, I thought, what are the chances? One in 10,000? But hell, the chances of me flying again were one in a million, one in 6 million maybe. So I said, okay. So I sent away to the Pardons Department in Washington, D.C. for all the paperwork, got it. This judge wrote a 3-page affidavit that is so strong and so emotional that to this day I cannot read it from page 1 to page 3 without getting tears in my eyes. I cannot believe the things this man says about me in this affidavit. I submitted my package. I worked for 2 years on that, sent the package in. I saw the first two lists come out. I saw Dan Rostenkowski's name on there. I'm going, oh, big deal. Here's, you know, mine's on a box in a shelf someplace. This is about political payback and not, it has nothing to do with merit. And on the last day, just when I let go, like everything always happens, on January the 20th of 2001, after I had duly gone out and gone to a home expo with my wife all day, which I just was my favorite thing of all time, I came in and there were 8 phone messages there, and the first one said excitedly, the final list is out and you're on it. You have a presidential pardon, which was a huge thing. Then came some of the other stuff about Mark Rich, and I have to stand up here and say, I don't know Mark Rich. I don't know Hugh Rodham. I never gave any money to the DNC. You know, I didn't do any of these things. I just dotted the I's and crossed the T's. Something I don't normally share, and I'll do it quickly, is that in 98, before I started the presidential pardon thing, there was talk about a new big book coming out. And a number of people there wanted me to write my story, and I did not want to do that. I just didn't want to do it. And they kept on and kept on and kept on, and it was getting real embarrassing. I was ducking them. I was having to make excuses, and finally I told my wife, I said, these are softer ways to just sit down and do it. So I sat down, I wrote the story, just to get them off my back. I sent it in. They said, it's going to be about 3 years. I said, I don't care. I just wanted the story off so I could tell everybody I've done it. So leave me alone. And I forgot about it. I really forgot about this whole thing. And 3 months after the presidential pardon, I get a letter from the GSO in New York. And I have no idea what the letter's about. None. And I open it up, and it says, greetings from the GSO in New York. I knew it couldn't be a draft notice because I'd served 11 and a half years. And the second sentence says, we're pleased to inform you that your story's been selected for inclusion in the 4th edition. And I thought, holy cow, who would have believed it? And I walked inside and I showed the letter to Barbara, and I didn't say anything about it to anyone except a counselor, the counselor who had been with me when all of these firestorms, this daily firestorm was just raining all over me. And I called him. He runs a treatment center in South Georgia, in Griffin. His name is Ed, but he's a Southerner, so when he picks the phone up, it's Ed, and it's 2 syllables. So I called him, and I read him this letter, and he said, my God, Almighty. He said, God Almighty. He said, you remember when we was together? And he said, all that stuff is just raining down on you. I said, oh, yeah, I remember. He said, remember when I kept telling you, man, if you can stay sober through this, it's going to make a hell of a book. I said, yeah, I remember that, too. That didn't provide a lot of comfort and solace at that time, I can tell you. And he says, well, God Almighty. He said, I didn't mean the book. I've had a wonderful journey. I love this program. I love the people in it. And I love each and every one of you. If you're a newcomer here and you came here with no hope, I hope you've heard something, because like you, I sat out there with no hope. And when I was on the edge of suicide, that's the extreme epitome of hopelessness. And I've seen things happen that I could never have dreamt. No one could have told me that I was in store for this journey when I looked out the window of that auto on that black night as I was being driven across the to the Minneapolis airport. Life was over. What I didn't know was a new one was beginning. And it's here because of folks like you, the people who cared enough about me to stay with me until I could begin to take those first few steps by myself. I will be eternally grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous, to each of you. And I just want to thank you for having me here, for keeping me sober another weekend, and for the wonderful hospitality you've shown me. Thank you, and God bless you.